there. This is Megan Marie, and I recently realized that I start every single podcast off almost exactly the same. So that was my slight attempt at a bit of variety. So we have a really exciting podcast for you today. I'm going to chat with both Carl Stewart and Brian Horton, who's our art director on Tomb Raider, about the recently revealed Tomb Raider box art. So we're going to kind of dive into the process of creating and collaborating on, you know, this imagery that'll be seen worldwide come launch day. After that, we're going to jump into an extended Take 5 session with Carl Stewart. I know many of you have some pressing questions based on details of our collector's editions or pre-order incentives now that we're really starting to roll those features out. So we're going to give Take 5 a bit more time and attention today. Thank you for tuning in to the Crystal Habit Podcast, Episode 16. Hope you enjoy. All right, everyone, thank you for listening. So as I promised, I have Carl and Brian here, and we're going to talk about something that I find personally fascinating, which is designing the cover of Tomb Raider, which is a huge, monumentous thing. And it was a really time-consuming process. It was something that you guys were working on for a long time. So first, thank you for joining me.
No sure, problem. It's great to be here.
It's good to be back on a podcast. Feels like it's been a while.
It has been a while.
I did one.
Well, you were like off having a baby last time, or rather,
I
your
did,
wife
and
was.
I'm back to my fighting ways.
You've got
your
free baby
weight is over.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll start with you, Carl.
Yes.
From a very broad sense, what makes a compelling cover when it comes to video games, and like, what are the things that it needs to jump off the shelves?
So in the case of Tomb Raider, much like some of the other games I've worked on, it has to tell a story. It has to bring the context of what you're selling to life. You have to look at it and kind of go, I get it, I understand it, it's emotionally driven, and I want to play it. That's the key thing, right? We want to look at a box and go, I want to play that game.
Yes.
I've worked in a few where, you know, Pony Friends, for instance. I don't know whether after doing that cover I was as happy with people sort of saying, I want to play that game. But for us, Tomb Raider, it's important that we created something which depicted a moment in time of the game that we had built the campaign up to that point, the narrative up to that point. And as everybody's aware, we've been very sort of strict in how we've introduced you to Lara. We've shown how she's growing within the world, how she's becoming stronger. And now we're at a point where the cover depicts a character that is about to embark on one of the best adventures ever. And that you couldn't look back and go, okay, well, the image of her is a tourniquet, you know, on the beach with the climbing axe holding the bandage. To us, yes, it's a great image, and it's probably one of the most iconic images of the entire campaign. But looking at that image, it didn't communicate a strong female lead in the way in which the cover that we have right now. So it really is a taking the player and taking the viewer on a journey, and the box should be sort of that last piece of the puzzle to make you feel like this is the world I want to be in.
I'm interested in diving just even a little deeper. From your past experience working on games, either of you, are there specific things that resonate stronger with consumers, like eye contact, faces versus body shots versus so on? Is there anything that you guys have noticed that stands out?
I think it's a little less scientific. I think what we found is we sort of had explored it. You know, we knew it when we saw it, kind of a thing. We went through a lot of iteration. And we you know, it's not just a matter of, you have this idea, and what everything Carl said is correct. You know, no matter what our cover was, it had to have those ingredients. It had to exist in this moment of time. It had to have an emotional element. But when it comes to actually how you realize that, you know, there's, you know, 1,000 answers that could have done that.
Yep.
So what we had to do is find the right combination of ingredients that were going to be both familiar to the people that were paying attention, but also brought something new, right? So that was our goal. Is like, what are those ingredients that bring something new? But as far as a formula of saying this is what works always on a cover, I think that ranges. Like, I know some of my favorite covers don't have any characters on the front, you know, and it could be just very, very simple. Like the Half-Life 2 box, I remember. It was like, oh my gosh, that's a rad cover. But that's a different take, right? What we knew we had, and one of the strengths of this franchise is Lara is, you know, the strength of this franchise, and we have invested a lot in her. So for us, we felt like Lara needed to be on the cover, but how we presented her and the way we presented her, one of the things we chose to do, which we've done in the past, is we didn't have her make direct eye contact, you know, and that was something we made a conscious decision of, but she has a very specific expression. She has an intent, you know, in her look, in her pose. And those are the ingredients we knew we wanted to have, is no matter what, she had to have a certain, you had to imagine there was something going on inside, and she was really contemplating what she was going through and what she was about to do.
It's interesting because, you know, retailers use the temporary black box with the Tomb Raider logo on it up on their placeholder pages for a long time. And so for a while, some people actually thought that our box art was just the Tomb Raider logo.
That would have been a
missed opportunity, because you're right, Lara is what people identify with.
And so, I think that's a point. I think every game is different and every story you tell is different. And the iconography of the franchise is very, very different. Like, I've worked on, you know, I think my remit right now is 36 games that I think I've just worked on every single front of box and every single one of them from a publishing capacity. And I can tell you, each one really is different, the way in which it's treated and the way in which it's executed on. And an example of that is we're doing Age of Conan. I remember we sat down with artists and we brought in an agency down in LA, and we worked on this image for probably the guts of about 4 months, which, if anybody sort of saw the image, is the one where, you know, Conan's charging towards you with a sword in his hand and he's got all his people behind him. And to us, that was an MMO world that we were creating. But then at an epiphany one night, I was like, you know what? This isn't iconic. This is just a scene. This isn't conveying. He may be looking at you, but there's just too much going on. And it's a beautiful render, and it will do great on a cover. But you know what? When I think Conan, I think sword. Mm-hmm. I think it's all about him and his weapon. And we actually completely, within 2 weeks, shifted our entire role across to putting a sword on the front of it. And that was it. That was all that had to go
there.
And that was the depiction. Whereas when I did Batman, it was like, what else were you going to put on the cover? It has to be Batman. It has
Batman
to be Batman
be
standing going, I am this big ass dude, and I'm going to kick everybody's ass. And that's you know, the thing. And there's tons of games, whether it be Reservoir Dogs, whether it be, you know, racing car games that we worked on. Each one is different, and each one has to be treated with respect to the story and the iconography and sort of the position that you, and the story you want to tell, the position you want to put it against its competitors as well.
The last thing I'll say on that, you know, just pure, you know, there is something that is common to the best covers, and they are iconic in some way, right?
Yep.
Carl used that word. An icon could be, you know, a logo, but it could also be a figure. You know, so I think something that's bold, the boldest covers
easily
are usually
identifiable.
Easily identifiable, something at a glance. If it's too busy, it tends not to be a great cover. So those are the things that we had to balance when we were doing.
And I think ours, when, you know, we were working on it, we went through many, I think, probably like 50 or 60 different images. And then when you get down to the final image that you like, it goes through like 100 iterations. And every single time, what was amazing, it was not like, you know, is the fabric this detailed? Is the water this perfect? It was like, is she conveying the right emotion in her face? Is she standing with the right pose? Is she holding her arm in the right way that we want to convey that story of just about to embark on a journey? And to us, the iconography in the image is not just about like the pose that she's in, but it's about the situation. We want players to look at that and go, I want to understand what she's gone through and I want to be a part of that journey. So the iconography can be a symbol of, you know, a sword, a static image, but it's equally as iconic when you look at it and you get an emotion. Something stands out at you. And that's why throughout the entire game, that's one of the things that we've tried to focus on, is making sure that when you play the game, when you put the controller down, it's an iconic game because it delivers on something which you may feel you've never seen before, experienced before. And that's the character growth and the arc of Lara Croft, in a way in which, you know, I'm at a point now where the game is done. We've played it so many times. I'm so excited for people to play it. We've had some journalists in, and I don't want to spoil anything, but it really does deliver on some emotions which will just, it'll make people so happy. And I think the image conveys that. And when people play the game, they look at the cover and they'll go, that works hand in hand. It really does.
So the tourniquet image wasn't quite right. Why were you, did you actually try it out? Did you go through a process of putting it on the front of box?
In the early stages of saying, okay, you know, we've got this image we have to create. Despite what some people may think, it's not as easy as just going, hey, that's a cool looking image. There you go. Put it on the front of box. We went through lots of focus testing. We both internally, externally, we went through the fact that you have to go through a process of, we look at things from a micro level. We're a part of this game every single day. Mm-hmm. And what we think is right generally is, because it's our game, we know we're building. But there are certain things that we just feel like, you know what, it's too important a decision to make without going outside of the studio and asking those questions. So for us, we created a range of images. up close and personal, more visceral in the world, more about exploration, dynamic movement. We really had a full portfolio of images, and we took them out. We did some focus testing with them in a couple of different territories, and we asked people what they liked about them. And the ones originally that we would have said, that's great, look at her with the Climanax doing this, people came back and went, no, I want to know more about her. Like, look at how intense that situation she's in. And the tourniquet did an element of that, but what it showed in focus testing was, I feel like I've seen it too many times. I feel like that's mm-hmm. something that it's become the image which is iconic for Tomb Raider, but it's not iconic for the story that you're trying to tell right now. So after all that focus testing, we came back and sat, and Brian, myself, and Brennick, and Daryl, and the team, and we started to look at other executions, taking the learnings from the focus testing, because there's no clear winners. There's only interpretation. There's only, you know, mm-hmm. people go, I like that, but I don't like the arm, and I don't like that. We just have to take all that and try and, you know, jumble it all up and come back with the answer in a way. And then once you've done that focus testing, then you try to say, okay, well, we've gotten guidance. We now know the basic areas we have to be in, and it's achieving on our pillars. Now we take it internal. And then once we're internal, then it goes through the filters of, we've had that feedback, but now it's our game, and we're trying to portray our vision.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would say on the tourniquet image, it did resonate. Like, it did test well, but, you know, a lot of it is because people understood it and they recognized it. The thing that we knew is there had to be an evolution too, just like we've been evolving the story, and that moment in time was not as appropriate for it as what we wanted to say mm-hmm. as what we ended up with. The other thing is we had an image that we thought was really strong of her, just sort of her, you know, her back, like looking at her, and she's preparing for something, for combat, climbing axe in one hand, bow in the other.
Slightly more aggressive looking.
More aggressive looking. And what we found was, like, people didn't, they couldn't relate to it. So once again, it came back to the emotion. It was like the right action, but not the right emotion. So all those things were super informative. And, you know, I think, you know, we would be remiss not to have done the focus test. I'm really happy we did. Mm-hmm. But to Carl's point, we didn't get one image out of that focus test that was like, oh, that's the one, let's do that. We got, well, these are the ones we kind of like, and then we made our own gut decisions, you know, and that was a combination of all of us, of Daryl, you know, Carl, myself, and Brian, and we're just, you know, sitting around like, all right, this is what we think we need to do. So it was that, you know, it's that final step you take has to be sort of an internal one, say, all right, this is what our gut says, and that's what we went with.
So I know we don't have it in front of us right now, but I have to imagine, especially Brian, it's burned into the back of your head, you know, it like the back of your mind, like the back of your hand. So what can you break down some of the features? It's amazing. If you go on the forum, some of the fans have literally broken down every aspect and said, this is what they are trying to convey here and here. And it's interesting. So could you kind of speak to some of the elements that you incorporated, the items on Lara, the looks, the poses, you know, what was the motivation with those?
What was pretty exciting is once we had a sketch done, Brent had done an amazing rendition sketch, you know.
Do you want to introduce, just in case somebody doesn't know who Brent is, you want to introduce him quickly?
Brennick Adams is our principal concept artist on the project, and I've worked with him from the very beginning, and he was instrumental in helping, you know, design Lara and the look of the world, and, you know, he's been my right-hand guy on this project, and, you know, I owe a lot of the success of the art direction is a co-collaboration with him. So mm-hmm. Bren's the guy. And so when Bren had done the sketch, which we had all sort of collaborated on the goals for, we intentionally had to manipulate some stuff that we had in our source material from the agency. And one of those things was, well, we knew we had to have the bow, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's something that we decided early on that this is going to be our iconic new, you know, weapon. So the bow was in there. We had the climbing axe mm-hmm. on her, you know, strapped to her side. And we had the pistol in there as well. So as far as like a weaponry, you know, loadout, you know, we wanted to have that combination of things. Those were the things that we knew that were important. But what's more important than her loadout was, you know, that the overall pose and attitude had to be correct. So we wanted something that was stoic, yet still wasn't stiff, right? So mm-hmm. there's still a little break in her gait. She's not completely straight up and down like classic Lara Croft with the arms, you know, arms out. She's got the one arm clutching the wound, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing that sort of looks and feels like tourniquet, right? When you look mm-hmm. at it, it has that same feel of the tourniquet image. But if you look at it, she's not grimacing in pain.
Yeah.
She's steeled. She's ready.
At this point, she's
like, yes, this is a wound.
Trivial.
I'm human, right? But she's already looking ahead. She's already planning and think, all right, I'm going to take on whatever is in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
This is nothing compared to what I have to deal with, right? So all those ingredients together, and then the context of the cave, and the shipwreck beach, th- those are all ingredients that sort of metaphorically tie to the island itself, a representation of the island, but also sort of that mental state that she's in. Mm-hmm. There is a light out there, you know, and she's surrounded by this darkness. That was all very conscious stuff. You know, it's subliminal, but it is a depiction of a person in a cave with a shipwrecked beach, but it also has that feeling of oppressiveness around her. Yet there's that one light sort of behind her, and she's the darker figure against the light. And I think all those ingredients, to me, you know, sort of speak to that story, mm-hmm. that emotion. So, Carl, do you have anything to add to that?
No, exactly what he said.
It's definitely, everybody has felt like it's very poignant and impactful, most certainly. So it's a, I personally love it. And I know
what's
many
great is
fans
it's been
do.
It's been weeks, and to listen to you talk like that, it was like, wow.
You can tell there was very much vision.
I remember those morning
vision.
Meetings where it was like we were getting super detailed.
Yeah.
We like to get really uber anal, as they say, on this.
But besides all that metaphor and all of that detail, you know, it had to work just as a pure iconic image too, right?
Mm-hmm. So much
so
balance.
Almost, even though that emotion is first, but second, very, very close second, has to be that pop and read and like, do you get it? Can you get it at a glance? Does it feel like Tomb Raider? And yeah.
And that's interesting, because one of my next question was, is this is incredibly different from any past Tomb Raider cover.
Right.
Was that intentional?
Yes.
Yes, definitely. But it was intentional, but it was also making sure that we kept the signature elements that we'd begun to tell this tale, this story on. So, you know, you can look at a girl standing there holding her arm, but when you start to add in the ships in the backgrounds, the thematics of the entire scene and lighting, and then the bow and the climax, and it becomes a signature. Mm-hmm. It becomes everything that we've learned about this girl up till now, that we always hoped that we'd get to a point in time where an image, you'd look at it and go, that's Lara Croft and that's Tomb Raider, right? And I believe we've done it in this one. If you had have put that image out on the very first day,
yeah,
people would have gone, like,
who is this?
Who are
this?
You trying to be? So I feel like this has been a culmination of you know, the last 2 years getting to this point now where people look at it and go convincingly, that is Lara Croft and I want to play that journey.
Okay, Brian, since we're getting specific on the cover, you know, some astute fans have noticed minor differences, he's laughing, between the cover image and Lara's in-game outfit, so specifically with the necklace, her belt being a little thicker. Can you speak at all to those?
Yes, I can. So let me give you a little context for this.
Yes.
So when we decided to do this cover, there was a lot of discussion, too, about how we'd do the final treatment. One was to use, we've been using VisualWorks for our renders, and we did want to include VisualWorks, but we took a step that we haven't done in any other of our previous campaign images, and we actually incorporated photography. Mm-hmm. And hired a model, and we wanted there to be that real extra layer of reality to this image. You know, so when we had an opportunity to, we worked with an amazing studio. By the way, we haven't even talked about them. Ignition has been an amazing partner in this.
Yes.
They are the house that literally put this cover together with us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that agency does a lot of fantastic photography for films, and they worked on the Batman campaign, yeah. And they're just amazing, right? So I flew down there a couple times for a couple shoots.
Yes, I remember you prepping for them.
Yeah, and we didn't quite capture it the first shoot, right? Mm-hmm. And we had to do a second shoot. But what was great about that is we were really trying to make sure that the details were as accurate as we could get them in photography. I mean, we didn't have an official costume. We had to sort of make an amalgamation of one. So that was why you're seeing some inconsistencies, like, for instance, on the necklace and on the belt. Now, what I'm sort of happy to report is once we got the VisualWorks render back, which was originally only supposed to be the head and the hair, they actually gave us a full body render. So I was able to get some ingredients from the VisualWorks model, and I've got them composited in. So you'll see a slightly different, you know, version in the final render, where the belt is actually closer to our, you know, original belt, but the necklace is not. So
okay.
So that's just some clarification. You know, so a little bit of you know, tease for those that are you know, looking for
really
it.
Really paying attention.
Really paying attention. You'll see a slightly different variation on the belt. And that worked. That did a couple things for us. One, it got it closer to the model. And two, it actually gave her a little bit of a better proportionality. You know, it made the torso to leg ratio look a little better. So those are the reasons we made that decision. after the first release of an image to say, all right, what can we do to, just to plus this up a little
bit? So that'll be changed on the
final,
the printed
version, you're going to see it. Now, this is just for, you know, this will be for those listening to this podcast. That's kind of the first time we've announced that. So
yeah, well, and I know that they very much appreciate it. It's kind of going into the behind the scenes because we don't speak to that much. I mean, I'm not sure that anybody knew that photography was part of an element in it. So
yeah, what's great about the photography is it gives you that extra level of nuance. It's really hard to get in a CG model, like even goosebumps and stuff like that. You know, some of that.
Oh, did you make her freezing? Did you spray water on her?
I have to say.
Speak to the shoot.
Okay, so the shoot was fun. We had an amazing model, and I am going to be bad because I can't remember her name right now, but she's a really talented model. And she literally went through two full days of just being soaked to the bone. You just keep spraying her with water. And, and we're talking about minute pose changes. Like, millimeters make huge differences in these full body shots. So I have thousands and thousands and thousands of pictures, and we had to scrub through them, you know, both Ignition and us. We had to scrub through these and say, well, which ones really are the right ingredients, right? And what we ended up doing is it wasn't even one photo. It was an amalgamation of a couple different ones. Like, oh, we like the legs here and the upper body here. And, you know, we were able to sort of Frankenstein together within, you know, very, I'm talking about minor stuff, like very much in the same, you know, position, just small little changes to make sure that we can get, you know, the right ingredients and really capture the essence of what was in Bren's original sketch. So
it went from sketch internally to photographing with Ignition down in LA, and then you composited the photos. And then, so what did Visual Works on top of that? They rendered directly right on top of it, the head, and composited it, or what was
so
the next step?
One small thing. So it started with an Ignition idea that we modified and did a sketch over. So an Ignition had done a proof of concept kind of stuff. And then we did Bren's sketch, and then we did the shoot. And then once we had the shoot and the pose locked from a photograph, we sent that over to Visual Works, and then they matched that pose and did and the lighting. In fact, Ignition sent us detailed lighting information of like the temperature and position and light, you know, all the light stuff, so Visual Works could simulate that in their environment. And then they did an awesome render, and then I worked with Ignition to composite some of that to get the final look that you see on the cover. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that some people just assume that there's just really talented guys like you and Bren, and you guys just worked a weekend and came up with an awesome image. You know, I think it's more of like a singular activity that someone tackles it based on the themes and emotions you want to convey. It's very interesting how many steps there
takes.
What do you think like the time frame working on this was, like the meat of it? I know you guys had to have been considering it as far back as you've been working on creative, but the core time frame for execution.
4 months.
4 months.
Yeah, it's not a fast process.
That's 4 months, but then there's also the months before where you're constantly thinking about and getting sort of ideas together. But when you actually start to finish, 4 months.
Carl, one more question for you. This is kind of a side note one, but I am interested. Are there any, because we are an international brand, we're a global brand, are there any considerations you guys had to make in terms of this image being appropriate for all audiences, for all territories?
I think we have to consider it. We have to be very careful that we don't upset people. In the same sense, we are developing a story and a narrative which we have to stay true to. So the smaller little things are, you know, the blood couldn't be too red because in certain territories they don't like, you know, bright red blood. But to be honest, the image has been adopted worldwide very well. There hasn't been any issues at all. But, you know, obviously if you're doing any image, you have to consider different territories and different nationalities and how people will convey that image and what it says to them. And, you know, what it says in America is might not be the same that it'll say in the Middle East, for instance, you know, and our games are going to be sold all over the world. So we have to be careful about how we present an image. So there is consideration put in, but I think we were lucky enough to say that when we nailed this one, it did everything it needed to do, and there wasn't very many little minor tweaks that had to be made, but not very many.
Okay. Any final thoughts, gentlemen?
Only that I am very bloody happy with what Brian and the team have managed to create. I think we've been working on this as a team for years now, absolute years, and to see it start to come together, not just in the game but also in our materials as we're presenting. We try and keep the highest quality in everything that we do, and people can see every single asset that we put out is very well thought out and planned. And I think this image really does everything and more that we wanted to do. If you had told me 3 years ago that this would be the image, I would have said, yes, lock it in there and then, but it's a journey you have to go on. I'm very very proud that we got to it.
Yeah, all I would say is, as I was saying, it isn't the work of any one person to make a cover like this. It is a bunch of talented people, including, you know, even consumer feedback. All the stuff's important to make a great cover. And, you know, we I'm very happy with here to hear the response. And, you know, we're pleased that we actually can hang it on a really great game. I mean, if at the end of this we had a great image, series of images, and it wasn't hanging on something that we believed in, it would ring a little hollow. But because you know, we put the same care and attention we put into this image, obviously the team puts into our game, and that's why, you know, I'll always end by saying it all comes down to the team. If it wasn't for what that team was able to do, we couldn't be doing what we're doing today.
I think that's a good note to end on. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Carl, you have to stick around so I can grill you for take 5 or maybe 10 today. But thank you, Brian. Enjoy your Thanksgiving weekend and your upcoming travel to show off Tomb Raider. That's exciting. All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, guys.
Appreciate it.
Okay, Carl, thank you for sticking around. We have a lot of questions this time because we just made a lot of large international announcements. So it turns out people have questions.
Getting no sleep, getting them all together.
And because you have a new baby.
Yeah, that too.
Dangerous combination, AAA game.
Very dangerous combination. I am running on fumes right now.
And coffee.
I go to sleep at 3:30 and I wake at 7 and go to the office.
We can sleep after lunch. Maybe.
Sleep when you're dead.
Okay, so let's get started because we do have a lot. So this one is probably the most important question, one that we've been, you know, we really wanted to find the right venue to address because it is an issue specifically in North America, the gamer, that some PC gamers are concerned with. So why did North America opt not to offer a physical PC edition of Tomb Raider in favor of digital download?
So there's two things to cover off here, which would be great. This is a great venue to be able to talk to this. Is one, we're responsible as a studio for developing the game and making sure that we position it correctly, you know, as a franchise. And we've spent a long time doing that. But once the game is developed, we have publishing departments all around the world. We have Square Enix LA, Square Enix America. We have Square Enix Europe, which has an export department catering to from Russia to China to you name it. And then we have Square Enix Japan, who look after those territories. So when we develop the game, we then ask those territories to help define the best way to be able to position that game in the market. I work very, very closely with all of the teams around the world, myself and the teams here, the brand team. We have daily calls with serious amounts of follow-ups, hence I'm up until 3:30 most mornings doing conference calls at midnight from my office at home. But those teams are tasked with coming back to us with the decisions that have to be made about the best way to put our game out and how to sell it. And in the case of the PC side, we looked at it from a European and a US perspective. And in Europe, the game is still very much widely a retail PC SKU, and it holds up very strongly in sales that you have to have it. It's part of the DNA. Whereas what we've found in North America is that PC sales have slowly but surely started to move into the digital space. And there is a fine line between producing a boxed copy at a certain quantity before it actually kind of starts eating into its own cost. And you think, is it worth producing? Because there's distribution costs, there's production costs, there's all these things that come into play that really you have to make a decision as a business. And I believe the decision was right. I think the decision to turn it into a digital PC version and distribute it means that, you know, it's accessible to more people. You know, like I said, it's a tough decision to make because we've always done a PC version of the game, but we believe that this is the right decision. And it's one that I have to support my teams around the world in whatever they decide they want to do.
Okay, so following up on that question, a quick little side note. Will North America be the only territory not to offer a physical PC edition? We've only announced the additions in North America and Europe so far, correct? Are we still establishing other territories?
No, I think it's safe to say that North America, and when we say North America, just so we're clear on their responsibilities, North America is Canada, North America itself, and then South America.
So also South America will be doing digital downloads.
Exactly. So that covers kind of their remit of responsibility. And then in Europe, with Square Enix Europe, there's UK, Germany, France, Spain, Italy, and then the export markets and so on. They're making the decision that they want to create a PC version, boxed version, which is great. Now, they'll also have a version on Steam, and I've had no doubt that it'll be on some other digital outlets as well to make the game as accessible as possible. So it's just the difference is in North America, they felt it was a skew that they didn't need to put out because it's a digital version and they wanted to put the weight behind it. And in Europe, they wanted to do a box copy. So throughout Europe, you will see box copies popping up all over the place. The final list, I'm to be perfectly honest, it's not because I know anything different, but I'm not going to go quoting different territories because from an export standpoint, I don't think it'd be fair to just start blurting out different countries that the game's going to be sold in because I need to see the final list in front of me.
And it's a long process. It takes a long time.
It's a long process, and there's also 70-something different versions. It's absolutely crazy. So what we will do, and I can kind of say we promise you that, is that in the very near future, we will give Megan the information to be able to post on the forum so you can get a full and concise list of every single territory.
Put together like one thread. We can keep updating.
Exactly.
Yep. We'll try to make it easier on you guys.
It wouldn't be right for me to just sit here and start blurting out territories and SKUs and who not, because they're decisions that, again, as I say, I trust my sales team to be able to pull all that together. And once we have it locked, we will publish it.
Great. Okay, so speaking of Steam, this is something that's very exciting. We got a lot of questions about. Will Steam utilize Steamworks?
Yes, there is a plan to use Steamworks. We are going to make an announcement pretty soon on exactly to what extent. But yes, it will. We love the idea of cloud-based saves. And if I play it at home on my laptop when I come into work, I want to be able to continue it. And, you know, I want to be able to all the benefits that offers. So, you know, more on that soon. But yes, it will incorporate it.
How about PC system requirements? I know that's something that a lot of once people want to know because they want to pre-order and they're deciding, should I get my 360? Is my PC strong enough?
Of course. What I'd say about PC requirements, and I'm sure everybody's heard this a million times before from other developers as well, is that you build the games in tandem, but you allow yourself some more time on the PC SKU purely because there's a smaller submission timeline for it to go to Gold Master. So what we mean by that is that there's a period of time when we have to lock off our console versions and we have to submit them to either Microsoft or Sony, and they have to review the game, and then there's a back and forth. And generally that takes, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks, you know, all said and done. Could be shorter, could be longer. Because of the PC version, we can literally put the PC version up on Steam 72 hours in advance, or any digital version for that matter. And if there's something that needs to be patched, we can patch it as often as need be. Hopefully you never have to do that.
Yeah.
But as we all know, on day one, there's normally just a nice little update to fix some little tweaks. So with the PC version, you're kind of afforded a little bit more time. And as a result of that, what we try and do is make sure that we lock down kind of the goals and the core elements in our console version. And then we come back to the PC and say, okay, well, here we've afforded ourselves this much time. Let's, you know, up-res all the textures. Let's get frame rate running even smoother. Let's do lighting a little bit more detail because we have ourselves some time. So that all comes back to specs, right? We need to make sure that the game is running optimally first before we turn around and say, here's the sort of CPU you need and here's the graphics card you need. We are working very closely with our partners AMD to make sure that some of those answers are being, or some of those questions are being answered sooner rather than later. We want to make sure that you know, people can go out and not only pre-order the game, but also pre-order their new graphics card from AMD that, you know, we're working with them on to be able to make sure our game's optimized for. And, you know, I love all that stuff as much as the next person, but I want to make sure that
we just want to wait until the information is as accurate as possible.
Exactly. And there's a lot of information, you know, when you when you look at all those lines of system recs, that's like, oh my God.
It really is overwhelming.
You know?
But, well, we're working on it, most certainly.
Yeah.
So why are there this is another one that we got, because we do have such a global fandom, so they're very aware of what goes on in other territories. Why are there differences between the North American and European collector's editions, you know, the digital versus physical CD, dry bag versus patches? Is this another thing that's just sort of up to what territories feel their consumers will like most?
Yeah, this, so I've worked on the North American publishing side for quite a number of years, and I will say there has never been a collector's edition that I've worked on that has been identical. And it's for many reasons. It's down to the amount of units being produced and the cost of shipping and the cost of creation, all the way down to consumer likes and dislikes. Mm-hmm. Generally, a lithograph that works in one territory might not work in another, or a free giveaway in one might not work in the other. So what I try and do from a brand standpoint is make sure we lock down some of the key things. And with this collector's edition, I was very, very sure on one. I've been working with PlayArts Kai for a number of months, probably 18 months in total, to create this new Lara Croft statue. And I always had it that was going to be in the collector's edition. Irrespective of where you bought it, who you bought it from, that was in the collector's edition. The second element is the survival tin. I always had this story in my head where, you know, when I did Batman, I created the Batman case and it looked like the Batarang and you opened it up. And then with Conan, I created this huge book. Mm-hmm. That was almost the book of Conan, that when you opened it up, there was this one page that kind of told you the poem, and when you opened that, everything was under it. So to me, it's about telling a story. Once you have the story told on the outer shell and the core elements or the core item defined inside of it, then you can get into the specifics, right? So for me, my goals are the survival tin, because I want to try and have everything in this tin that people can keep. This hinge tin that feels like it's washed up on a mm-hmm. beach after the Endurance shipwrecked, and what would have been in it is maybe the items that they would have, from, you know, bits of food to some water packs to some first aid kit. And that to me was a cool thing that I thought, let's house it all inside of that. So that was a global thing. Then there was a PlayArt's Kai statue. Apart from that, then, the game.
Mm-hmm. Kind of
right, that's the main thing. And then after that, we kind of just laid out the territories, and I had many calls back and forth where we just looked at, you know, costs and timings and production schedules, and if we wanted to do X item, how long would it take? And then ops gets involved, and, you know, from an ops standpoint, we have to have everything delivered to a certain place at a certain time, and then also, you know, we're so close to the game. I need to be able to let the marketing teams around the world also give their input and have something that they really feel needs to be a part of, because it's a team effort, as Brian had mentioned in one of our previous chats about the cover, and everybody should be able to come back and say, hey, you know what? This is the territory I live and work in.
This feels right for us.
So the difference is only because there's many different moving parts, and really it's a decision that gets made as a team as to what is the best thing. And, you know, I'm sure I want to get the European one, because I love the idea of the dry bag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this survival dry bag is a cool little thing. It just didn't work out to be in the North American ones for a couple of different reasons, and we're not doing it over here. But, you know,
but we have these cool little patches.
Yeah, there's patches, and then I think that the lithograph, mm-hmm. and then they got the soundtrack, which we're going to be announcing. Which when does this go out, Megan?
Probably Friday.
Oh,
not yet.
I can't
not quite
introduce
yet. Don't spoil
who
anything.
The person is. I was going to give it the
nope.
world exclusive.
Nope.
So yeah, they have the soundtrack by beep beep, Mister, and we'll see. I'm very happy with where we are with the collector's edition, but we didn't try and change them for any other reason other than the ones that I just said.
Not a trivial decision.
It wasn't trivial.
All right, next question. So speaking to pre-order bonuses, collector's editions, and so on, some people are starting to get worried because they don't see the collector's editions or pre-order bonuses for their specific territory. Should they fret?
No, don't fret at all.
Don't fret.
I have many calls with the teams around the world about where we are in the stages of announcing different things. What I will say is that in an organization as big as Square Enix, and with as many retailers and territories as we do cater for around the world, it takes a little bit of time for things to be able to get locked and get communicated and get distributed. So, for instance, in North America and UK and Germany and France, it's very easy to turn around and say, right, let's lock in this offer. We talk to the retailers. But when we start looking at territories further afield, we have distribution partners. Mm-hmm. They only have specific windows to get into retailers. Sometimes it's a little bit slower getting stuff up on a website than it is to do it here when we're in control of it. So what I will say is, do not fret. The export team and the teams around the world outside of just that are working hard and tirelessly. We have the guys in here 24/7 working on various different assets. As you can imagine, there's a lot of stuff to be created.
A lot of localized images.
And we've built our website to allow you to be able to sort of dip in and find out where these territories are. So, for instance, I think in probably the next week or so, I believe we turn on a tab which basically says rest of world, And when you click on that, it'll bring up all the flags of all the countries around the world. And when you click on your flag, it'll bring up a list of all your retailers, and it'll give you a link straight back to their website as to what's
a pre-order. So we're working on it, so, most certainly. Yeah.
It's quite an undertaking, I have to say.
It is. It's been an exciting process, though. So another question for pre-orders. A couple of people have wondered, if I order a version that has a character skin, will Lara wear it the whole game, or can I choose when she's going to wear it?
You can choose when you want to wear it. You can go into the menu, and you can swap it out at any time.
That I think people have already sort of started to identify with Lara's new outfit, and so they're like, I want to see the new one, but I want her to be able to wear the old one too.
Yeah, you can swap them out. We've built it into the menu where you'll be able to
pop in, pop out.
And I think depending on where you buy it, what combination you do, we have the menu built where you can have several outfits, and you can just change them as you play through the game. So
very cool. I'm excited about that one. Okay, so now we're out of the territory of pre-orders and all of that. We're into some of the regular questions. This has been a busy month. We have a couple of people wondering if we'll ever show off the different like comparison shots, screenshots for PC versus PlayStation 3 versus 360. Is that something we would do?
Yeah, that's something that we have in the calendar for the new year. That's you always do that. What I will say is we don't go out of our way to put three screenshots together and go, here are the differences, because I don't think that's fair on anybody, because, you know, PC guys get to have the highest res textures because they have unlimited memory in a way. Whereas there's differences to everyone. So we'll leave it to you to draw the comparisons, but don't expect us to be putting out a gallery
spot the
of
difference.
Here's the three of them, spot the difference.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen.
But it is something that we'll
do. It is something that we'll do. The same screenshot, of course, will be released for all three platforms, because we are trying to present the game to those three audiences to make sure that they make a fair decision on which platform they want to buy.
Right. Someone else asks, can you play the game from beginning to end without using the RPG system? I don't know why they would not want to use it. It's awesome.
Let me see. There's probably one or two things that you'd probably get close to having to do, but I don't know why you'd want to do it.
So if you just wanted to plow through the story, skip finding all the salvage, skip doing bonus things for XP, you can.
You can.
But there's so many cool things to unlock in the game.
For instance, you've got to go into your base camp to unlock your Climanax. Otherwise, you can't get beyond the Kong doors to get further in. So there's things that you gotta do. But then
it's kind of up to you how involved you want to go.
Yeah. Let's just say if somebody did that, they would be scratching the surface of an awesome experience, because sort of that rich tapestry that we've built inside of Tomb Raider. Did I just use the analogy of rich tapestry? That world that we've built inside of Tomb Raider is about Lara's character arc. So in order to see that really come to life and see how she's gotten stronger and more equipped to deal with her environments and the people around her, you want to go in. Like, we're just going to be shown off soon. Like there's a melee piece where, the awesome thing is she's able to upgrade to dirty tricks, and, that's one of the upgrades. And when she gets close to somebody and she knocks them down, she picks up the closest rock and she kind of smacks them across the head. And to see that happen, you're like, oh,
I love the one where she kind of ducks down and throws dirt in people's eyes.
Yeah, like
that's such a scrappy, fun mood.
That's the thing that brings a character to life. So I wouldn't imagine anybody would ever play the game start to finish without doing it. And if they did, hopefully it's through a second playthrough to see what it's like, and they didn't just sort of dilute the experience or fracture the experience by trying to do that for the sake of it.
Okay, we're almost there. Will there be some type of weather system in the game, or will it be unique to each sequence? Do we have persistent weather or daytime or so on?
It's a blend, to be honest. So here's where we are. When you come into an area such as the Night Hub, for instance, where we meet Roth for the first time, it's raining and it's nighttime. When you leave that space and you move on to, let's say, World War II area, and I get to a base camp, and I think, I've got a piece of gear, I want to go back and unlock some things. If it's daytime where you are there, when you use your base camp to fast travel back to the Roth area, which was called the Night Hub, it will now be daytime.
Okay.
So it's persistent in the sense that you'll be able to move around the world, and whatever you're in, you'll be in when you fast travel. It's not persistent in the sense that, dynamic, in the sense that it'll turn from day to night in front of your eyes. That's not going to happen. But as you move around the world, because we're trying to tell this story of the days and the week after Lara crash lands on the island. So really the story is tailored to be driven around the sort of thematics of the situation she's in and the nighttime or daytime, whatever it may be. But as you use fast travel, you will land back in a space at the exact same time and day state.
It's really unique to see because it gives you a chance to re-explore areas with different moods in that environment. It's really nice.
Yeah, I love it. And to be honest, we can't say too much in this, but journalists who have been playing the game so far, you know, have kind of seen sections where they've come in, they've done something, they've, you know, fended themselves from the scavengers, and then they've moved on, and then they've come back in, and they've gone, holy crap, they're back in here, but they haven't just spawned in here. They're actually working.
It feels like
a living, breathing world. They're having conversations with each other about, based on what they've heard about you further on in the story. So it feels like these spaces are alive, and that's a very important thing to us.
It is. Final question. This is another tough one. Is the geocaching partnership still happening?
So we have been working on an idea for quite a while, and due to time constraints, we decided not to go ahead with that particular geocache opportunity. We start looking at the idea that we had originally, and things evolve. A mechanic that may have worked 2 years ago may not be a mechanic that works now. So we have a subset of that which we're going to be announcing in the very near future that we've been working with our team down in LA. And I look forward to talking to you more about that when we've made the announcement. But at this time, we are actually not going to be working directly with geocaching because the situation and the mechanics just didn't work out the way in which we felt we needed to be able to deliver the experience to the fans.
Okay. Carl, thank you. Do you know how many questions that was?
10.
12.
Oh, dear. That's not
too bad.
Thank
you. You have made my life so much easier by answering these. So I very much appreciate it. And now we're going to go have turkey dinner.
Yes,
at
I'm
the
supposed
studio.
To be upstairs right now carving
yes.
turkey for
I'm
the
gonna
team.
I'm going to save.
So
I'm going to close GarageBand because that's what I use. And I'm going to go eat some turkey.
Excellent. Thank you very much, y'all.
Thank
Happy
you, everyone.
Thanksgiving, even though you'll hear this the day after. And
yes.
for you guys outside of America, forget I said that.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
And that is it for this episode of the Crystal Habit Podcast. For those of you in the United States, I hope you enjoy your long Thanksgiving weekend. And for the rest of you worldwide, enjoy your regularly scheduled programming. Till next time.